You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Hopkins, tōko ingoa, no mai haere mai, ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome back to The Wire for Rahina Monday, the 19th of July. I'm happy to be back with you for a second week. As your host, I'm Jessica Hopkins, and I'm going to be with you for the next hour. Coming up on the show, I'll be talking to Green Party co-leader James Shaw about the farmers' protest that happened over the weekend, as well as 35 years of homosexual law reform in Aotearoa. And I'll also be speaking to Associate Professor Susan Fountain about the gender gap in news. Now, I am joined by our producer, Louis, this morning. However, he's just busy at work right now, so I'll be talking about some of his pieces until he can come in. So first up, Louis's going to be talking to the Police Association's president, Chris Cahill, on police demanding better protections. Then Samoa Observer journalist James Robertson on post-election Samoa and recent developments that are happening over there. And then finally, the University of Auckland's Dr. Lisa Reynolds on LSD microdosing for cancer patients. Kawa I wariwari, I ahe, ana koutou, te whakarongo, te ene kōrero. Ano he pākehere, roki roki mā runga I te pai. Tuku o Irigangi Pōhō, me haere ki 95BFM mā Kati Kom. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on our website. And as always, if you have any thoughts on our pieces today, text 5395 or call 309 3879 to let us know.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
Our weekly chat with James Shaw is back this week, and today we're going to be talking about the farmers' protests that happened over the weekend. Farmers were protesting against ute tax and environmental regulations. We'll also be discussing the arrest of four kaitiaki at Putiki and 35 years of homosexual law reform in Aotearoa. We started off our interview discussing whether we can support farmers while reducing emissions from agriculture.
There's a huge amount of interest in the agricultural sector around organic and regenerative farming, which is a much lower impact form of farming that also tends to attract much higher prices for our goods on the international stage. So anywhere between 2 and 5 times the commodity price for milk and meat and kind of various other value-added goods that come from the agricultural sector. And we know that there are a number of farms around the country that have already been doing a lot of this in one form or another. And what I would like to see is us supporting the rollout of those techniques, you know, right across the country.
Have there been examples that you've seen of farmers working within these regulations effectively?
Oh, loads. Right up and down the country, in pretty much every region, in every type of soil, with every type of farming system, there are farmers who are operating within environmental limits, whether that's in terms of greenhouse gas emissions or nitrogen into the soil and into the water. There's kind of farmers at the leading edge of this all over the place, and they're doing really well for themselves as a result.
And amongst the protests, people were concerned about racist and misogynistic messages that they saw from some people that were protesting. Is this something that is of concern to you, and what do you think that we could do about this sort of thing happening?
Well, look, it does concern me, but I think that we should be very careful not to dismiss the protests as a whole, because there is this group of misogynist, racist, kind of generally anti-government, kind of people who were there. I wouldn't say that was the majority concern or the majority of the people who were on those protests.
And another thing I wanted to speak to you about was a few days ago for Kaitiaki at Putiki. were arrested for what police described as willful trespassing. Do you believe that this is going against the right for peaceful protest, and were they given fair treatment in comparison to the farmers who protested over the weekend?
Well, I don't think that you can draw comparisons, because the farmers were not kind of, you know, I think they're very different situations, but I do think that, you know, they do have a right to protest, and I think that if you look at the history there, it is clear that there are real concerns about the, you know, about a lack of consultation with mana whenua, about the very real concern around the penguins and other wildlife that are indigenous at the site, and that those haven't been addressed. And the Greens have been down there supporting the kaitiaki at Putiki for a while now. Our Auckland Central MP, Chloe Swarbrick, has been heavily involved in that. Our Māori MPs, our Māori caucus known as Te Matawaka, they have been out there and have spent time talking with mana whenua about those concerns as well. And so I am worried that the police are being heavy-handed at this site, and I think it's an example of what can happen when you have a poor process leading to these kinds of protests.
Kaitiaki were reporting that they were getting threats and that they received injuries from this event. So what would your advice be to better handle that situation?
Well, first of all, I don't believe that there's any excuse for violence. And in particular, you know, this is a... I mean, this is about building a boat marina, right? It's not kind of the kind of, you know, I don't think it's a sort of a scale of issue that should see this level of tension. It should be a resolvable issue, and I think it's highly regrettable that actually the situation's been allowed to get to this point.
Another thing that I wanted to speak to you about is that we recently celebrated 35 years of homosexual law reform, and the Green Party had a panel on this. Were you in attendance at this, and what did the party take away from this discussion?
I actually wasn't there, I'm sorry. I was on a conference at the time, and so I missed it. I do want to say, though, that obviously we've been huge supporters of homosexual law reform. One of our former MPs, Kevin Haig, was very involved back in those days before he became a Member of Parliament in kind of leading that reform movement, and I think it is something to be celebrated.
Did you have an opportunity to discuss with the MPs that were in attendance about some of the conversations that were had?
No, we haven't. There's a three-week parliamentary recess on at the moment, and so, you know, MPs have been back in their kind of home constituencies or travelling around the country, and we haven't had a chance to dock in with each other yet.
I wanted to highlight to you one of the speakers at the panel, Chenille Lau. They spoke on pro-Māori Pacific and Asian changes they made within their position at the Rainbow Youth Board. And then afterwards, they said they experienced racism and transphobia, including a petition to have them kicked off the board. Does the Green Party stand by Chenille, and what would your message be about this?
Well, I think the Green Party's basic position here is that we stand for the rights and for the protection of all takatāpui. I think, you know, any kind of threats or anything like that is completely unacceptable just because someone was voicing an opinion. We have had a very long track record of standing up for everybody in the rainbow community, kind of regardless of, you know, what colour of the rainbow they represent.
And just lastly, what are the Green Party's next steps going to be in regards to LGBTQIA Takatāpui Plus law reform in Aotearoa?
So Elizabeth Kerikeri is our MP who's leading on this at the moment, and she has Members Bill in the ballot in order to extend the rights of Takatāpui in Aotearoa, particularly looking at health. Is one of the really big issues where there's still a real deficiency in the level of support that people get from the New Zealand health system. And I think that we'll be looking at the upcoming health reforms through that lens as well.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.
Yes, that was James Shaw, my first chat with James, and we'll be right back after a short break.
I believe you are a star.
95BFM and Under the Radar present Dimmer, as you've never heard it before. A seven-piece Dimmer band play the iconic I Believe You Are a Star album in full. Dimmer, live at the beautiful Mercury Theatre. The first show sold out in days. A second show has just been announced, Friday, September 24th. Get your tickets now from iTicket.
I believe you are a star.
Tree huggers,
planet lovers,
fashion disruptors.
Get ready for less waste, more love
with Outlive. Outlive redesigns and upcycles pre-loved clothing and textiles into rad, unique, one-of-a-kind bags. Teaming up with like-minded local charities like Sea Cleaners means that with every Outlive bag, more goes back into the community, inspiring conscious change through regenerative fashion.
Outlive. Eco-friendly, slow fashion handbags, purses and totes.
Go to outlive.co or find them on Facebook and Insta at Outlive Official.
Southbound Records, New Zealand's largest range of new vinyl, a fantastic curated selection of secondhand, plus all the accessories you need. Brushes, cleaners, sleeves, crates and more. Their in-store experts can help you out whatever genre you're into. So support your local and head into Southbound today. Southbound Records, your vinyl specialist. Pop in at 132 Simon Street or order online.
Swap the hard stuff for mental clarity and performance this dry July with Arepa, New Zealand's number one brain drink. Caffeine-free, plant-based and clinically tested, Arepa is proven by neuroscience to keep you calm and thinking clear when you need it most. Arepa, 100% natural effects you can feel. The world's smartest brain food. Found in all good supermarkets or buy online at drinkarepa.com.
Wednesdays, one to four bridge. Tune in for your fair share of great open-minded tracks. A wide range of supportive and encouraging music with Bridge.
Kick back and chill with the Wednesday 1 to 4 with Bridge. Only on 95BFM. Thanks to the same old Ponsonby Social Club.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. And next up, we have a piece from Louis, who is back in the studio. Louis, can you tell us about this next piece you've got?
Yes, I can. The New Zealand Police Association have demanded better protections for officers, including faster access to firearms and working in pairs. This has come after violence against officers has increased in recent years, especially from firearms. I spoke to President of the Police Association, Chris Kahu, about the demands and why these are needed. To start, I asked him to outline the protections officers have called for.
Well, the real issue we have at the moment is the number of firearms that have been used by criminals, not just against police, but against members of the public, and the willingness of those people to use them. So our members are increasingly feel at risk from this and want to be generally armed. What they did wish to have earlier was armed response teams, so trained experienced officers who could be deployed quickly in the community when these incidents happened. Unfortunately, they were withdrawn. So it's leaving police with very limited options for their safety. So if they can't get something along the lines of armed response teams redeployed, it leaves them with little option but to be generally armed themselves.
So specifically, what are the benefits that either armed response teams or individuals being armed?
Well, the reality is when you're confronted with a firearm, there's very limited other options you can take to safely resolve that issue. What the value of armed response teams was, these were highly trained officers who were experienced. They were able to deploy quickly because rather than being the current system with armed offender squad who have to be called out and take sometimes more than an hour to get to an event, they would be working and on the ground ready to deploy straight away. They were then able to take control of these situations and look at a variety of options to resolve the situation. So that's the advantage of armed response teams. Obviously, the advantage of having a firearm on you at all times is when you're confronted with a situation that you weren't expecting a firearm to be involved in, such as a routine traffic stop, which is some of the most dangerous things police officers become involved in, they are able to protect themselves with that firearm immediately rather than have to try and get it out of a lockbox in a vehicle, which is impractical if confronted with a firearm with no warning.
Is this a direct response to recent events, or is it something that officers have called for a long time?
It's been building up for many years. It probably reached a sort of a change in views of officers in 2009, when we had multiple officers shot and killed in one 12-month period. And the most highlighted of the most well-known event being the siege in Napier, where Len Snee was killed. But we also had other officers shot the same year. That sort of brought about the push for general arming on a much higher level. And the use of firearms since then has just continued to grow. And the real change is the willingness of criminals to use firearms and actually pull the trigger, which has increased dramatically in the last 5 years.
So how come, if there has been the increase, especially recently, have government and the police force not armed officers more frequently?
Well, there is a lot of what we call temporary carriage orders issued. So they are when a specific threat is known, such as there might be an armed gunman on the loose, or if there's an offender who has made direct threats and is known to have firearms out there. A temporary carriage order is issued by district commanders that allows officers to arm themselves. But in general, there's big resistance from both government and the senior managers in police to generally arming as a matter of course. And a lot of that is based on lack of research or a misunderstanding of the level of risk that actually is posed out there. And as I often say, it's easy for people like myself who are not out on the streets at night taking these risks to say they don't want officers to be generally armed, but the reality is it's those officers who have to face these ever-growing risks.
Yeah, because some of the opposition is along racial lines, with many saying that there are disproportionate impacts of policing on different groups, as Māori are nine times more likely to have a dog set upon them than Pākehā for similar incidents. If police do regularly carry guns, will this not make impacts on Māori much more severe?
Well, I think those are the issues that need to be understood in this debate. I mean, we have to be really clear that the issue of Māori overrepresentation in a variety of statistics, such as the ones you quote, aren't necessarily driven by how police approach things, but are driven by other issues within society, the failure of education system, the family violence that these people come from in the first place, our drug addiction problems, our poor mental health outcomes for New Zealanders, and police are at the front line of having to deal with these things. But they're factors to be considered without a doubt, but we also have to remember that Māori and Pacifica are well overrepresented in the victims of crime, and it's very often it's Māori and Pacifica who are the people who are being injured, assaulted or threatened with these firearms that police are then called to would deal with, and those victims also have the right to the protections that police could offer if they were armed.
So how then, if police are armed, would they aim to make sure that the use of firearms is equally spread and not disproportionate among different groups?
Well, it's that unfortunately life doesn't work like that. You can't say this week we're going to only deal with Māori, next week we'll deal with Pākehā. You know, the fact of life for policing is they have to deal with what is in front of them. So then it's a matter of understanding what is contributing to some of the disproportionate statistics that involve Māori and Pacifica to a slightly lesser degree in being overrepresented in negative statistics in the criminal justice system. And that's where police have begun a research project with Waikato University to understand those issues. And there's three areas they're looking at there, which is who police stop and deal with, the use of force by police, and what people are charged and what they are charged with. So we'll be very interested to see what that research leads to. But for a frontline police officer today, the reality is they've got to deal with what they're sent to and what they find they're confronted with, and that's why they feel they need better protections than they can.
But the statistics I quote there related to similar or the same incidents where Māori more likely to have a dog set on them even though they've committed the same crime or they're charged with the same thing.
Now, I don't support what I say those statistics purport to is the number of Māori and Pacifica who police interact with is overrepresentative. And that is what society needs to look at. Why are Māori and Pacifica overrepresented in crime stats? Why are they overrepresented in victimisations? If police are going to attend assaults, for instance, and we know Māori are much higher represented as the victims of those assaults, then it stands to common sense that they will also be overrepresented in the offenders for those assaults. So it's a much wider society issue than saying police are making these decisions based on race. They're making the decisions based on what they have to attend because that's where the calls for service are coming from.
On a slightly different note, if police do become increasingly armed, is there also the issue that the public will increase their gun use to counter these protections by officers?
Well, I think that horse has already bolted. I mean, daily now, media are getting reports of firearms in the hands of criminals. We're seeing even more of it. I mean, you see the high-profile ones that make the headlines, but, over the weekend, I've had 6 or 7 different reports of officers dealing with offenders who've had access to firearms, either in their vehicles or in their houses, just metres away from being able to use them if they wanted to. And that's the reality, that genie's already out of the bottle, unfortunately. So many people have access to firearms.
And finally, are there any alternatives to arming officers? Is there anything else that the police force could do instead?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing and the most successful thing we can do is to get better trained officers out on the street with better access to firearms, working 24/7. So something along the lines of armed response teams, which were unpopular in certain communities. But if we explain what they're actually trying to do, which is make the community safer and also protect police officers, I think they have some real potential. So that is officers with the armed offenders type skills, but deployed 24/7 rather than having to be called out.
That was New Zealand Police Association President Chris Cahill speaking on better protection for officers.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
And next up we have another piece by me. So the 2020 Global Media Monitoring Project revealed that in New Zealand and around the world, women are still more likely to present rather than and report the news rather than appear in it. On the monitoring day in 2020, radio news in Aotearoa had the lowest proportion of women as sources, despite every radio presenter and reporter being female. I talked to Associate Professor Susan Fountain, who has been involved in the New Zealand proportion of this research, about increasing gender representation in the news we cover. We started off our discussion by talking about the project and its findings.
Every 5 years, a whole lot of countries look at the media coverage in their countries on that particular day. And there's all sorts of guidelines about what media to include and how many media. So we include traditional media and also new media. And then there's a whole kind of coding process where people go through and count the number of women who are in the news versus the number of men and look at things like age, what roles women are playing in the news, whether they're just sort of people who have provided some personal experience because they witnessed a train crash or something like that, or whether they're in the news because they're an expert or an elected representative. So it's that kind of thing.
In looking over it, were you surprised by any of the results from this research?
I guess I was surprised at aspects of the New Zealand findings in particular. The project happens globally, so I think there was 116 countries that took part for the 2021. So the global findings do sort of show very slow but sort of constant change, like 1% kind of change in the number of women as sources, those kind of things. So it's very slow, incremental change. The New Zealand results, which I've been involved in since 2000, kind of go all over the place, and that's probably quite interesting to me, because every time I do one of these or am involved in one of these projects, I feel like, you know, where's New Zealand going to sit today? And to be honest, a lot of it does vary depending on what's in the news agenda. So I was kind of probably not surprised that we had a really high proportion of women politicians in the news on Monitoring Day last year, because the Monitoring Day fell during the New Zealand general election campaign, and we had two women leading the two main parties. So that wasn't sort of particularly surprising. I was also, sadly, not surprised by the really low proportion of women who were in sports stories or who were sports sources, such as coaches or players. And I was kind of pleasantly surprised, I guess, by the amount of economic news that there was that included women's perspectives. And that was quite a different sort of pattern. We've seen these sort of consistencies, I guess, in New Zealand around politics and sports having a really big impact on how representative women's appearances are. But yeah, in terms of the economic news, that was quite different, and I thought that was really encouraging.
Despite some of this progress, the report estimated that it will take 67 years to close the gender gap in news. What do you believe could be done to speed up this process?
For New Zealand, it would be projected as not taking quite so long to close the gap, which is good. I guess the other kind of thing that I'm a little bit sort of cautious about or interested about in terms of that closing the gap idea is that, at least when you look at New Zealand, we have really high proportions of women working in the media. And so often you might think, okay, if we want to have more women's voices in the media, let's get more women reporting the news. And there's been a lot of kind of efforts around that over, you know, the last sort of 50 years or so. But actually, in New Zealand, what we're not seeing is women reporters using women's sources in quite the same sort of rates in which they are globally. So although we have quite high proportions of, like we have 68% of reporters and presenters in the New Zealand findings were women, but only 33% of sources. So that's kind of like about, you know, half a source for each woman. And then when you look at the global findings, you've got fewer reporters and presenters who are women, but they're using female sources at slightly higher rates. So I guess when I think about what we might be able to achieve in New Zealand, I think, okay, we've sort of already achieved these quite high proportions of women in the news, but we're maybe not seeing quite the traction in terms of journalistic output representing women more. So I guess the things that we need to think about more are, A, having more public discussions and getting more audience involvement and commentary and critique about this kind of thing. And, you know, sometimes social media has a role to play here. There might be, you know, things that you can do to observe or call out some kind of media practices that you think could be more representative. I think we also need to invest a little bit more in kind of industry leadership, or talk more about what the industry could be doing, thinking about women's progressions through their journalistic careers. How could we encourage more women into the kind of journalistic decision-making roles that might have more of an impact on women's representation? And then, yeah, keep the conversations up and draw in kind of champions of this cause. I'm really encouraged by the number of journalists who kind of speak out about this a little bit more now. Like there are, you know, women reporters such as Zoe George, Katie Harris, who have said, you know, talked about some of the things that they've seen or observed or been told about how women are maybe treated in newsrooms or how some of the journalistic decisions are made. So I think that's really good, because that demystifies some of the process as well.
The report also mentioned that in Aotearoa, women make up almost half of academic experts and activist sources. So then, in your opinion, why might we still not be seeing more women sources being included in media?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it it does come back to sometimes what's in the news on that day. I guess, you know, we have to be a little bit cautious about how, you know, this is just one day every 5 years, and the news agenda of the day will impact on that. I think it was really encouraging that we had, you know, this high proportion of women as sort of activists and experts, particularly in the context of COVID, because, you know, some of that activism and commentary is about COVID from both a health and economic perspective. So that's a really good thing. What was the second part of your question there?
Yeah, that's all right. I guess you kind of answered it already in another question, but something else I wanted to talk to you about was whether the report highlighted anything about representation of Māori and Pacifica women in media in Aotearoa.
Yeah, not specifically. So the global project does try at different times to put in some other kind of areas where people might make observations, and we do a kind of a qualitative process in here as well. So we did notice that there was some, in New Zealand, there was some kind of quite positive reporting about Māori and Pacifica women. So for instance, one of the stories that I've talked about in the national report was a story about young job seekers who were hit hard by the COVID pandemic. And the story used a young Pacifica woman talking about her experiences with unemployment and also with retraining and getting a new job. So that was a really nice story about employment for young people, and it used a young Pacifica woman as kind of, you know, a representative of young people's experiences in employment. And it was a positive story as well, because she had gone through some retraining and had a really good outcome. So those kind of things are really positive. We also did find some stories, very few stories in New Zealand, and this is probably another thing that we have to think about a little bit more in terms of these global patterns. Globally, there's a very small core of stories that might talk about or draw attention to areas such as discrimination and gender equality that are reported in the news. But actually in New Zealand, we don't tend to have a lot of those types of stories. And that's been quite consistent through the Global Media Monitoring Project, which I think is quite interesting. Actually, one of the few stories that we captured in the sample last year was a story about a Māori woman who was going through the court system, and she was using a human rights framework to try and argue for a different sort of jury selection process, because arguing that some of the racial biases towards Māori would impact her right to a free trial. And that was a news story that was covered by the Dominion Post about her appeal and her references to some sort of best practice, international best practice, such as that in Canada around the court system. So we did have a sort of a small number of stories where women's kind of broader experiences that are sort of intersected by ethnicity and even age were included.
And on this particular day that the report was conducted, radio news had the lowest proportion of women as sources. I guess as a maker of radio news, what can people in my position be aware of to better improve our performance in the 2025 report?
Yeah, I guess one of the things that occurs to me is that radio news is often the shortest news, right? You know, like, it's very time sensitive. The type of bulletins that we were looking at were kind of like, even on Radio New Zealand, they were perhaps like the 6 p.m. news bulletin. They're not particularly long. And what you tend to find is that when there is a shorter amount of space, there are fewer women sources. And we find the inverse of this when we look at the internet. In New Zealand, the internet stories, you know, you can scroll on and on. It can be pages and pages or screens and screens of a story being bits added to it, more photos being added to it. And when you look at those types of stories, they're more likely to include women. So I think that comes down to that kind of idea about the definitions of news and trying to put in place those kind of sort of checks and balances, and even in the consciousness of the reporters thinking, okay, we've only got, you know, the ability to use maybe one source. Let's really make that source count. That doesn't mean it always has to be a woman, but let's think about the overall gender balance, even though sometimes we can be really pushed because of our small amounts of space to have fewer people in the news. No, I guess I would just say that, you know, like I think in lots of ways the New Zealand results are really encouraging. You know, we have got this really high proportion of women as reporters and presenters, and we have kind of hit that magic, you know, the magic sort of marker around representation is often seen as being at about 30%. So we have got now over 30% of news sources being women. And I think there's some really good progress there. I guess just the only thing that I kind of know, because I've been involved with this project for about 20 years, is that New Zealand has done really well before as well. Back in 2000, when we had Helen Clark and Jenny Shipley leading the two main parties, and there was a lot of political news on the agenda on Monitoring Day, we also had a lot of women in the news. And, you know, I think sometimes in New Zealand we can get a little bit self-congratulatory and think, okay, you know, we've achieved this, we've done it, you know, now we're fine. And then after that, in sort of 2010 and 2015 particularly, New Zealand actually really went backwards in terms of sources. So we were down to about 18% of our news sources were women. So while this is a really good result for us, I think we just have to be mindful that, you know, progress will be is more likely to be achieved when it's kind of consistent and steady, and we have to keep our eye on this kind of thing. We have to keep having these discussions.
And that was, we'll be back right after the break. That was Professor Susan Fountain. Stay tuned because Louie's got some more pieces for us coming up soon.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
On the prowl for your new friendly local? Look no further than Scarecrow, the cafe with great food and groceries, plentiful vegan fare also, alongside a great buzz. Right beside Albert Park, Scarecrow is located at 33 Victoria Street East. Explore their range of food, which is rated amongst the best in town by Heart of the City. Browse their gifts, local flowers, organic teas and coffees. You can also find them at 811 Mount Eden Road. To learn more, call them on 09 377 1333 or shop online for Auckland-wide delivery at scarecrow.co.nz.
It's truly the perfect blend of comfort, protection and breathability. So yes, I'm wearing socks and sandals right now.
Hey, my word.
Doesn't wool and leather together make you feel a little animalistic?
Absolutely.
Shaky Isles Coffee. Brewed different. For soiree sophisticates and footwear fanciers. Go to shakyisles.co.nz.
Not all bread is created equal. In fact, some bread is pretty shit.
You might as well be spreading your Marmite on a chocolate bar.
Bread and Butter's sourdough is real bread, using ancient techniques and organic and regeneratively grown ingredients. Choose substance over speed. Choose age and beauty. Check out their online delivery options or head in store for brunch, great coffee and more homemade pastries than you can shake a baguette at.
Bread and Butter, the best sourdough in town.
Breadandbutter.nz.
Hello there, friend. I heard you were into immersive multimedia musical spectaculars. Yeah, sick. Well, if you want to win tickets to see Rian Sheehan and Ali Lieberman live, then just surf through to your B card and stay tuned to 95BFM all this week for your cue to enter. Capiche? Yeah? 95BFM and Luke present Rian Sheehan and Ali Lieberman Spectral Atmospheres with support from Jasmine Mary, Saturday, September 11th at Q Theatre. Presented by Loop and 95BFM. Tickets on sale now from loop.co.nz.
The Wire.
A winner has still not been decided in Samoa's general election, which took place in April. Since then, the Human Rights Protection Party, or HRPP, has been operating in a caretaker role. However, by-elections in the past months have favoured the opposition Fast Party, who have taken the result to Samoa's High Court. I spoke to editor at the Samoa Observer, James Robertson, about developments in the Court of Appeal process. To start, I asked him to briefly explain recent events.
Well, it's been a long time since the election and we still have no government. It's been, in fact, close to 100 days since Samoa went to the poll on the 9th of April. And we've since had no change of government, despite voters marginally preferring the opposition party to the long-dominant Human Rights Protection Party. And that's largely because the caretaker prime minister, who has ruled over the country for some 22 years, refuses to convene parliament. And that's basically brought the entire nation to a political standstill. Things are coming to a head now, though. We have before the court a case that was brought last Friday and argued on the question of whether or not the court could force Parliament to convene, and if that was successful, then we would see a change in government in Samoa and the swearing-in of Fiume Faida Naomi Matapa, the first female Prime Minister in this nation.
How soon might we expect to see a proper resolution to the election results?
Well, that depends on a number of factors. The first is the court decision, and that will determine whether or not the court has the authority, or as the other argument would have it, the head of state, to determine when an election is called. Now, that decision will come sometime before the 2nd of August. So that is when the head of state has said he would prefer to have parliament called. Then I suppose the other factor in the background is whether or not that decision is accepted or not. Now, we've seen the caretaker prime minister and the head of state so far publicly basically thumb their noses at the court and its authority. The Supreme Court previously issued a very strongly worded judgment suggesting that those who defied its orders and refused to convene parliament would face heavy criminal penalties. But they didn't seem to change their public attitudes much at all. So that'll be the second question, I suppose, is whether or not the decision is accepted and acted upon, and if not, what happens then? But in terms of the decision itself, I would expect sometime this week.
Yeah, because the HRPP were not initially involved in the Court of Appeal process, but they've been given a chance to be heard now. What impacts might this have on the decision-making?
It's unclear what the value of the HRPP itself being added to the case will have, because it doesn't really change the course of the arguments, because the arguments are really those of principle. But what we've seen in response to the election is, I suppose you might call it post-election lawfare, to use an old cliche. We've seen basically the HRPP, the ruling party, throw everything they have at the wall, legally speaking. They've started mounting now criminal charges or criminal complaints against members of the FARC opposition party, accusing them of defamation and treasonous acts and things like that. Basically, their having involved themselves in this court case in some way does not surprise me. It might give them more avenues for appeal, even though there's a very limited scope for that, of course, the Court of Appeal being the apex court in Samoa, but it doesn't surprise me if they chose to tack themselves off.
Yeah, so on the HRPP's recent actions, they've written to the Judicial Services Commission for action against the Chief Justice for incompetence, but this has been called disrespectful and an insult by Member of Parliament Olofiti Vai. Is this a desperate move from the HRPP?
Yes, it is a fairly desperate move. You've got to remember that Samoa was without a Chief Justice for a very long time indeed, a period of about 9 months, during which time the Prime Minister says he was waiting to receive, as he put it, the secret whisper from God as to whom he should choose to be a Chief Justice. And he chose, of course, a New Zealand-based Samoan, His Honour Satiu Makiwi Perese. And he's occupied that position now for about a year and was winning the Prime Minister's praises up until about a month ago, or 2 months ago, I suppose, up until about May, when post-election challenges to the legality of individual election seats were not going his party's way, the HRPP's way. In fact, their initial election majority, or initial election position, of having 25 seats in a chamber of 51 has gone down to 18 seats in a chamber of 51 because they've lost seven court cases. And that sort of sparked the Prime Minister's ire and began to get him and other members of his party to make complaints about the competency or otherwise of the Chief Justice. Now, that was probably disrespectful. It's probably never a good idea to get the Chief Justice of the nation on the wrong side. But they've ultimately failed in their ultimate goal, which was to have him recused from the court case, which was heard on Friday, as being the ultimate court case on whether or not Parliament can be convened and whether or not, if it is convened, then, of course, the opposition will have the numbers to form a new government. So, really, that was a wait, that was a backfire, that complaint, because the JSC met on Tuesday. They didn't formally decide on the decision, but it looks like that they won't declare the Chief Justice.
Yeah, without a government being officially formed yet, has this had any impact on initiatives in Samoa, which would have been taking place in the several months that have happened after the election?
No, well, the business of government in Samoa has been ongoing. The government has invoked a legally contested clause in the Constitution that allows it to requisition one quarter of the annual budget it needs to keep the country going during this period. So that's allowed them to tide over the public service and keep the machinery of government moving. But the big question, I suppose, over that is one of principle. And that is whether or not the spending is in line with the will of the democratically elected government of Samoa, which we know it's not, as the HRPP lost the election.
What's the public reaction been in Samoa to the post-election results?
Well, it's been fairly muted, I suppose, in a sense. I mean, Samoa is a society that places a lot of value on, I would say, peace and cohesion and stability, and discourages conflicts between villages over matters like this. A lot of decisions are based on consensus, and they're stuck through on that matter. So there isn't the sort of surge of protest that you might expect in a country like, say, New Zealand or Australia. But there's nonetheless been a fairly detectable rise in public opposition towards the Human Rights Protection Party, which has been quite a remarkable thing to see. You might walk down the streets of Apia and see people who are openly wearing shirts bearing the opposition logo. We have a column in our newspaper every day called Street Talk, where we interview members of the public for their opinions. And people are now quite openly talking about their dislike of the current caretaker government, the Human Rights Protection Party government, which has, of course, been the dominant political force in Samoa for 40 years. So while it hasn't been hugely visible, it has been very, very perceptible indeed.
That was editor at the Samoa Observer, James Robertson, on recent developments following the Samoan election. Next up, researchers at the University of Auckland are preparing research about the potential for LSD microdosing for late-stage cancer patients. Information concerning microdosing is limited, and most is very recent, after the United States banned research into psychedelic drugs in the 1970s. I spoke to the project's lead researcher, Dr. Lisa Reynolds, who is a clinical health psychologist at the University of Auckland. I began by asking her to explain the potential for microdosing for cancer patients.
Okay, so I have been designing a study along with some colleagues looking at whether LSD microdosing alongside a psychotherapy, called meaning-centered therapy, might be helpful in advanced cancer patients who have anxiety or depression and are facing a shortened life expectancy. We know that living with advanced cancer can be really challenging. People can, can bring up fears of death and fears of dying and fears of what lies ahead and feelings of grief and loss around what people are leaving as well. And meaning-centered therapy is a therapy. There's plenty of evidence to show that it's a really effective therapy for people at that end of life stage. But what we're interested in seeing is whether LSD microdosing alongside that therapy might actually make the therapy work more quickly and more effectively, which, of course, when we're thinking about people with an advanced cancer, timeliness is really important.
Do you have any expectations going into the research?
Well, there are kind of anecdotal reports. There are some early stage research that suggests that a microdosing of a psychedelic might be helpful in terms of making people more open to new ideas, more cognitively flexible, more creative. It might have some impact in terms of helping people's mood, you know, so improving people's mood. And so our thinking is that maybe an LSD, you know, LSD microdosing or psychedelic microdosing, we're just particularly using LSD, that might make therapy, so psychotherapy, you know, if people are more open to ideas, that might be that's going to make the therapy work better. But, you know, this is really early stage in the kind of trajectory of research. So what we find, you know, this, I'm a researcher, I'm interested in finding out whether or not it's helpful. And so we're going to be pitching it against a placebo. And, you know, we'll see what happens. But our hypothesis is that it is going to be helpful, but we need the research to test that.
So how exactly does microdosing differ from a typical LSD trip?
Well, it differs in the dosage, obviously. So a microdose is typically about a tenth of a full psychedelic dose. So a psychedelic dose is going to kind of, it induces, you know, what we think of when we think of a sort of like a psychedelic trip or a psychedelic experience. So people's perceptions of reality are distorted and people have a kind of a non-ordinary state. So a microdose, it's a much, much smaller dose, and it's pitched at a level where perceptions are not overtly altered. So people might be able to sort of tell that something's going on, or they might not. It's going to be much harder to tell. So the actual experience is different. But in theory, people might think, you know, more creatively and be more openly and be able to see things from perspectives that maybe they weren't able to see before. But they won't feel like they're tripping.
If there are ideas that there may be benefits to microdosing, why hasn't there been much research around it? Because a lot of it's relatively recent.
It is recent for sure. You might be aware that research into the use of psychedelics at any dose was essentially completely stopped in the late 60s, early 70s, and we have a real dearth of knowledge about psychedelics in general. But in the last decade, there's been a few studies, not many, but a handful of studies that have looked at the potential of a high dose that induces a full psychedelic experience. And I think the microdosing that research is just yet to come. But there's certainly been a lot of anecdotal reports of people microdosing. You know, there's, you know, reports of people in, you know, Silicon Valley, you know, using microdosing to do sort of long hours and do the kind of creative work that, you know, working in technology requires. So there is a kind of a grey literature of underground use, and the research is just, you know, yet to catch up on that. So it's great to be doing a project that's doing that. Yep.
In this limited research, have there been any, I guess, findings of withdrawals and negative impacts of microdosing?
Not that I've seen. Well, as I say, the research that I've seen that have been done in the, you know, like randomised controlled trials or clinical, the effects have been positive. I think I saw one trial that said that there may be some increased short-term anxiety, so in some people. The overall kind of early stage outcomes so far have been that it's the very safe to use.
So if research does become more prevalent and if there are supposed benefits to microdosing, do you expect it to become something that will be introduced in New Zealand, or are the negative attitudes still too great?
Well, there certainly is a lot of stigma around psychedelics, and some of that there's probably some, you know, some evidence around that, but there's certainly a lot of misinformation around the use of psychedelics. The long term, I'm a clinician, I'm a health psychologist, so I care about working with people with treatments and approaches that are helpful. So, you know, the point for me around doing this research is to see if there might be another offering or another treatment approach that may be able to offer benefit. And, you know, if we find positive outcomes in the research, then absolutely I would be hoping that ultimately this could be a treatment approach that we would roll out to more to the population of interest, of particular interest for me, which is cancer patients, but there would be many other applications too.
So,
I think, you know, for people who have other mental health issues.
So whereabouts would you, for your research, how would you go about trialing something that has such a stigma around it? How do you introduce it to people?
I guess just sort of stepping back from that question for a moment. I mean, I have done, and with some colleagues, we've done some qualitative research and also quantitative research, actually asking people about their perceptions of psychedelics. And my feeling and some of the results that we're getting out of that research is that perceptions are changing, and they're changing quickly. So, you know, if we'd asked this question 10 years ago, I think we would have heard a lot of that stigmatizing, you know, and a lot of fear and negative perceptions around psychedelics. But you'll be aware that there's been a lot of conversation. Pretty much every time you open up the Sunday paper, there's an article on psychedelics. You know, there's Netflix documentaries, and I mean, the awareness is growing, and I think it's growing really quickly around the possibility of psychedelics. So I think that stigma, although it's something we're aware of, I think it's changing quickly.
That was Dr. Lisa Reynolds, who is leading research at the University of Auckland into microdosing for late-stage cancer patients.
That was The Wire.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.